Today I'm interested in talking about recipes for happiness. Whenever we build or create something, we're always involved in a process of assembly. On one hand, I could call it information assembly, but we tend to look at it differently. We think in terms of assembling building materials, information, components, ingredients, parts, people. We assemble people on teams, resources, we assemble financial backing, etc. We do it all the time in a lot of different activities in our lives. And the process is so common that we can overlook its importance. And I think it can be applied, and this is really where it's overlooked, in the assembly of the non-physical. We don't think in terms of assembling or creating in terms of non-physical aspects of our lives, generally speaking. It's very simple, and you could say this to a child, and they would understand it immediately, that we can't make a cake without the ingredients. But we don't think similarly when it comes to using abstract ingredients to making spiritual peace or happiness or mental clarity or emotional stability or physical health or even financial security or family harmony. We just kind of hope that stuff will happen. So it is much easier and more common to assemble physical ingredients in an attempt to create a physical result. It's easy. Adding physical flour and physical eggs and physical milk and physical this and physical that to going into making a physical cake is something that we experience from our earliest years right up to our latest years. But the idea of assembling non-physical energies to create a physical result is something that we're not typically taught. We're taught some things in Sunday schools and in church settings, and sometimes, if we're fortunate, around the kitchen or dining room table about the non-physical aspects. But we're not really taught this idea that the assembly of non-physical information, non-physical ingredients, always precedes the physical assembly of information or ingredients. The statement, "I want a glass of water," sounds pretty physically oriented as a statement. In reality, I have information about the following. One, I know myself. I know that I'm talking about myself when I use I in a sentence. I know and think in terms of myself as a specific identity. I have information that allows me to differentiate wants from other energy experiences. Wanting a glass of water and being in pain are two different things, although the thirst could be uncomfortable, that causes me to know I want something. So my ability to differentiate and process information is there. And all of that is happening on a non-physical level, the mental processing thereof. I have information about water, and I know enough to have connected it to my wanting. When I'm thirsty and I say I want a glass of water, I don't think I want a toy or a new pair of sneakers or a bicycle or I want to fly to the moon or something. I connect that to water. And then I have information about a glass and its use as a container and a delivery system, if you will, that will transport water from wherever it came from, the water faucet or a well or a bottle, and bring it to me. I can transport it to me and use it to deliver that water to myself. There's a lot of information that is non-physical in that very simple physical statement of, I want water. In the process of creation, that is what I refer to as information assembly, we only have information about the desired end result initially. That's where we start. Then we start gathering information ingredients that we think might be needed in order to create the thing that we want. Sometimes in this process of defining what we want, we would have experienced some other energy exchange that says to us, this is not that comfortable. This is not exactly what I want. And if we're wise enough, we will take that experience of noticing what we don't want and immediately start searching, trying to discover what it is we do want. If we think of making a cake, we actually focus on acquiring and then mixing and then processing, I'll call that baking in the case of a cake, the ingredients. When we open the oven after a certain time and temperature, the result is the cake. We've added trust to this process. We trusted that the mixing the ingredients in a certain way that was described in the recipe and in certain quantities that was also described in the recipe, baked at a certain temperature for a certain time, will produce a predictable result. It's interesting to me that when I was a child, I was one of seven children, so we were cautioned when my mother was baking a cake or one of my older sisters were baking a cake not to run through the kitchen because the cake would fall. Even at a very early age, we realized, we were taught, we were trained, we were frightened into believing that we could mess up a predictable result by our physicality. Now, I presume that that's because the house itself in those days was constructed of wood, and somebody running through the kitchen, boisterous boys and carrying on and so on, could cause vibrations that's in the physical structure of the house, which would be transmitted to the oven, which could cause the cake to fall. I don't think that's a reality today in places with concrete slabs and like the house I live in now, but perhaps it's true. But even then, we were frightened of the negative causes of our own physicality. Interesting area. I grew up in a farming community on the eastern end of Long Island, although my family was not involved in farming. But I recognized over the years that it requires tremendous amount of trust, because a farmer every spring is about to invest a tremendous amount of money, maybe pretty much everything, riding on buying seed, putting it into the soil, hoping that soil over the course of the summer and early fall is going to produce a predictable result that can be sold to pay for all the investment up front and allow enough money for the family to survive over the winter and buy seed and ideally with something left over for the family to have a decent quality of life. The amount of trust involved in that process, to me, was amazing and almost miraculous when you see something pop through the soil. I'm thinking that the assembly of health and happiness is not unlike those processes of baking a cake or farming. There is the adding of energetic ingredients that will result in a predictable outcome. Now, what are those ingredients? Because I'm the creator or the organizer of this concept and framework that I refer to as the 12 worlds, and just briefly, let me just run through that, because I find it to be a convenient framework that shows me at any one moment where my activity and my energies are being directed. The spiritual, the mental, the physical, the emotional, family, financial, career, social, leisure, community, political, and maintenance, those 12 worlds, says to me I can be investing my energy, I can be planting seed thoughts in one or more of those fields or worlds, and it can produce the results that I want. And so I use the 12 worlds on a regular basis kind of for recipe building. If we talk about recipes for happiness, you know already that there are basically an infinite number of recipes for happiness. We have so many different things going on for us individually, individual preferences and so on, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a while. But we're going to be creating our recipes for health and happiness, or we're going to be accepting what somebody else has handed to us. I personally think it's a lot better to think about what it is we want, what happiness really represents to us individually, and then go into the assembly of the information or the ingredients necessary to produce that happiness that's most meaningful to us. And if we were to use the 12 worlds as a framework, I mean, there are lots of different ways to look at that, but that's a cool one as far as I'm concerned. As soon as we start defining what happiness is, then we've taken a huge step or number of steps in the direction of producing that. We are already starting to connect to that creation we've just put our attention and intention on. That is happiness. A cool exercise might be for each of us to do this. And it has to do with defining these areas. How would you define spiritual health and happiness, mental health and happiness, emotional health and happiness, physical health and happiness, family health and happiness, career, financial, social, leisure, political, community, and maintenance health and happiness? Just taking the time to go through that, and you don't have to do all 12 of those worlds. That's a lot of information. That could be a lot of time and effort devoted to that. But if you chose any one of those worlds that seems most to be needing adjustment of the current recipe you are using to create in that particular world, you might be pleased with the results of that. So as we start to think in terms of the ingredients necessary for any one of these happinesses in any one of those worlds, we've started to attract the ingredients necessary for the manifestation of that condition that we today would define as happiness. Knowing a recipe, though, and being able to execute it are two different things. I remember a few years back when we were on a wine tour in Sonoma, California, that my wife Marianne had put together. She owns a winery in California. And so we went from where we were living outside of California to California with a group of people. And she conducted the tour. She knows winery owners and so on. So it was fantastic. So one of the events that she had coordinated was to go to a culinary school in Sonoma. And so we would go into the culinary school late one afternoon. And this is what the format was going to be. There were about a dozen, 15 of us. We were divided into teams at the culinary school, and we were handed recipes, individual pieces or components, if you will, of the dinner that we were going to create as a team or set of teams, and then the staff that was supervising each one of these creations would turn around and become the wait staff later on, and they would serve us dinner with the wines that we had accumulated over the course of this trip that Marianne had put together. And it was great. I consider myself one of the least comfortable people in a kitchen, unless I'm washing the dishes. I can recall when I was about 14, my mother said to me, as a result of my offer to make her dinner one night, she was a nurse, she worked 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and I said, Mommy, I'll make you dinner. She said, okay, that'd be nice. And so maybe 9:30 at night, I'm preparing a cup of tea and two pieces of toast. She looked at me and said, Tom, you better marry somebody who can cook. I said, why, Mommy, why? She said, because otherwise you're going to starve to death. And she's right. I have so little interest and comfort in creating food stuff that my real skill in my relationship with my wife in the kitchen is the cleanup duty. So anyway, back to the Culinary Institute in Sonoma, California. Most of us were on two or three teams, and we were doing this and doing asparagus and doing this and so on. And so that was okay because they were pretty simple and straightforward. You know, pick up this, scrape this, pick up this, chop that. I pretty much could handle that. But later, several of us were on a dessert team. There were multiple desserts, but I was on the one that was preparing an elaborate chocolate dessert. The dessert turned out to be beautiful and delicious. But the thing that really struck me is I had the recipe, and there were two or three of us working on it, is I never could actually figure out what it was I was doing. I was going through the motions and I was actually doing it, but I had such a little connection to the rhythm, or I couldn't see the whole picture. I was like a little child that was at a step. I couldn't hear the beat of the music, and it was just, it was really very uncomfortable for me. And I'm trying not to be bothered by it, and trying to find the beat or the rhythm, if you will, and get into step, and I wasn't able to do it. And, you know, nobody seemed to notice what I was going through, and I'm trying to think that most people there were, had food expertise, so they were certainly not experiencing what I was experiencing. And so I'm looking at them, and everybody seems to know what they're doing and feel good about it, and I'm like a fish out of water. It was really, really odd. And it reminds me of a time when I was 16 years old, and my brother was managing a restaurant, 2 years older than I was, said he needed help one night, and I went and was helping to plate food. And so I was like in assembly line, and I never could get into the rhythm. I couldn't, like, what goes next? And that's the other time dealing with that that was very odd to me, that I couldn't find the rhythm of handling that energetic process, that assembly of the food, that mixing and carrying on or producing the recipe, even though in both of those cases, the written recipe, the written structure was so obvious, but it still was very difficult. So to me, having a recipe in one hand and being able to execute it on the other hand is a totally different thing. So that assembly of information, whether it's making a dessert or dinner or building a home or writing a book or creating a website or creating a training program, all of them require a list of materials needed, as well as the process of assembling those ingredients. So besides having a list of the ingredients and the quantities needed and the description of that process, add this first, stir lightly, you know, that sort of thing, for me, instructions need to include how to do it as well as how not to do it in order to give me more confidence. I got to know how to do it right, and I need to know how to do it wrong. So once I understand how wide that path is of right and wrong, you know, am I on a tightrope? That if you stir it one time too many, you've ruined it, or, you know, you're okay with that idea. So knowing how to do it right and knowing how to do it wrong is, to me, really a very important thing to know, so you can understand how to deviate from the straight and narrow and still be safe. Following directions has never really been a strong point, because one of the needs that I respond to and seek to keep whole is my need for freedom. So it's very difficult for me, and you know, I'm willing to be this way, to refuse to follow instructions or follow rules and so on. The first step in developing a recipe for happiness, and as I mentioned before, there could be an infinite number of recipes for happiness, depending on which of the worlds, if you will, we were looking at and who is doing the looking, you or you or you or you or me. All of that's going to be variable. We, much like our tastes with food, we'll have different tastes with regard to happiness. And it would pay for us to know our own tastes. Everybody could say that happiness is delicious, but if you said delicious to one person, they would go, well, delicious means this. You know, in terms of food, I recently read that food has a variety of characteristics that we generally speak about. And of course, there are a lot more than just these handful. Sweet and sour, spicy, umami, and salty. And of course, there are hot and cold, and there are textures like crunchy and smooth and so on. And it goes on and on like that. There are different preferences in those areas. And when you start to recognize what your preferences are, I think all of us have a better ability to choose those things that will deliver, make it easier for us to translate them into happiness if we know what makes us happy. So the question I had to myself after thinking about this was, does happiness have different flavors and different textures, kind of like food does? And I think the answer is, well, maybe we could define that. When we have a relationship with somebody that calls a male-female relationship, let's say we're youngsters, 10, 12, 15, 18, something in that area, physical appearance is one of the key characteristics. That's the first part of the recipe. Well, oh, she's pretty. Oh, he's handsome. Oh, she's nice. He's nice. We start adding those things together, and we start assembling what we believe to be the recipe that's going to produce happiness in terms of our relationship. I can look at the qualities now. I'm a little older than that physically. Sometimes even mentally I'm older than that. The qualities of spirituality, mentality, that is thinking, imagining, reasoning, that sort of thing, and emotionality, feeling, sensing, etc., and physicality, moving, touching, etc. All of those things can vary tremendously in individual recipes for happiness. Our son, we've got two sons, our son Jonathan is a hiker, camper, climber. And if you said to Jonathan, what makes you happy? He would say, hiking, camping, climbing, being out, sleeping in a sleeping bag, you know, being up early in the morning, catching a rising sun. He's a photographer. He absolutely loves that. And I know he's had a previous relationship with a gal, beautiful gal, who didn't like to have her picture taken, and also preferred to sit and read the New York Times. This is in California. Sit and read the New York Times. He said, let's go out. Let's go hiking. Let's go camping. Let's ride bikes. Let's do this. Let's go jogging. Let's do this. And what made his girlfriend at that time happier was sitting, cup of coffee, reading the New York Times on a Sunday morning. And you'd go, there are different preferences right there. And you can imagine that somebody who prefers to read scientific journals as compared to, say, romance novels, I might be able to project that first person with the scientific journals prefers reasoning to the imagining or feeling that is going to be triggered by a romance novel. Doesn't make either one of those wrong, just makes them different. And if you're going to be in a relationship with somebody whose interpretation of happiness is way, way different and in conflict with you, and if there's an element of non-acceptance of one another's versions of happiness, then you can imagine that that could be problematic. Some people like horror movies. Not me. But I'm guessing that these people like to experience the feelings of being frightened, all those feelings that are provoked in a horror movie, right? Fear, relief, dread, fear, relief, risk, danger, dread, horror, awful things, screaming, and all those other energy patterns, and maybe the relief when they walk out of the movie going, phew, I'm glad that's not real. But those things are appealing to some people, but they're not appealing to other people. I think we can zero in on some of our inclination toward a recipe for happiness by asking a few questions, and not necessarily in this order, but this may make it easier, is if we could see what our information is about each of these areas. I seem to think that we have missing information or erroneous information if our recipes for happiness are not producing the desired result. And so a question that I would ask is, what is your body for? What is your body for? What are your emotions for? What is your thinking ability for? So obviously I've dealt with the physical, emotional, and mental aspects. What is your body for? What are your emotions for? What is your thinking ability for? If we could answer those questions, and this is a cool way to do it, I learned this in California a bunch of years ago, where you can sit down with a question like that, write out that question, and then everything that comes to mind in response to that question. Sometimes it's helpful to reread it or speak it aloud, ask it aloud to yourself, is you write down everything that pops into your mind in response to that question. You'd literally be accessing judgments, criticisms, opinion, superstitions, things you've heard, prejudices, all kinds of stuff that you would have accumulated over the course of your life. A lot of this stuff pops into your awareness at that moment. You would have heard it on the street corner from other kids your own age back then, or you would have been taught this as part of adult points of view or dogma, and you just put all of this stuff on a piece of paper, and now all of a sudden you start to recognize the ingredients that you have acquired regarding this particular area of your life. And then it becomes pretty interesting to be able to sort through that and go, whoa, this ingredient is not going to work. This is not going to work. And you can start shifting that. I learned this idea about asking these kind of open questions and see what happens and then write it down from a guy at a meeting in, or actually a public demonstration in Los Angeles. And he was describing a situation where a person had come to him and said, I need help. It was a woman. I need help. And this is my challenge. I've become very successful. I really apply myself. I buy a home or a condo. I stop working. The home or condo mortgages don't get paid. I get foreclosed. I get evicted. I become homeless. I end up living on the streets. I then migrate to a shelter. And then I start rehabilitating. And then I start to become really functional. Then I go back to getting a job. I become very effective. I become successful. And I start earning a lot of money. And the person says, wow, that is amazingly clear detail. Wow. How is that possible that you know all those ingredients? She said, I've done it 3 times, and I want to be able to stop. So she would go through this cycle. And what happened with this person's coaching or insights helped her to see is that in her family of origin, home was a torture chamber. But part of her happiness was to have a home. So she would go through the motions to create a home. Soon as she would have a home, she would tune into the images of home as a torture chamber and have to get rid of it by refusing to pay for it, stopping working, and try to escape from the home because she felt as though the next step was it was going to turn into that torture chamber again. And so she was looking for help how to break that cycle. So she clearly had connected bad with good, that is, the bad experiences to home, and then there were good connected to home, and then so she was able, because of her sorting through all of her experiences, all of her judgments, all of her beliefs, all of her fears, all of her thoughts about home and work and money, that she was able to identify what it was that she was creating. She would create these two conflicting recipes, if you will, or using two different recipes to create, one to create a home and one to get rid of a home. And once she understood what she was doing, she was free to make her own choices about it. So in our own answering of those questions, what our body is for, emotions are for, our thinking ability for, if we actually think about it, and that is, don't give a memorized answer, I think we would be much better off. It would give us clues as to what information is missing or what misinformation we may have that no longer serves us. Some people may say, and I've heard this, my body is to honor God. To me, that sounds memorized and not actually thought of. So, does using our body to honor God, does that mean we should use our body to have pleasure? Or does that mean we should deny physical pleasure in order to honor God? There are two schools of thought on that, maybe many more, but people are divided at least into those two camps. Don't feel good about your body. No. That dishonors God. And others go, hello, who created this? Flagellants think whipping or scourging their bodies honors God, while a physical therapy person, a physical therapist may say, if they can work and help a person get into alignment, get into balance, get into their body, be able to appreciate this body and be pain-free and healthy, that would be more honoring God. I think there are a lot of justification to be able to say that the body is a temple. Now, that thought doesn't preclude somebody saying, yeah, well, you know, you don't have sex in a temple, so better stay away from that kind of pleasure, and so on. I certainly have this awareness that bodies are used to cause pleasure, but they're also used to cause pain. And most of us have, I'm sure everybody has experiences of causing pain through the use of our bodies. Fist fight if you're a boy, or something you've said, or so on and so forth. We have used our bodies to cause pain for people. And if we still have lingering relationships of this energetic pattern of, uh-oh, my body is a dangerous thing, it's a scary thing, it's a bad thing, it's a it attracted pain, it caused pain, this can be healed. One of the things, personally, I've dealt with over the years, I presume I'm still dealing with it, is the physical body. My father was a violent alcoholic. He could use his body to cause pain. Didn't cause pain for me directly, but he did for my mother, and verbally to others in the family, physically to my mother. And so, big, strong guy. So what does that mean? Strong equals bad or dangerous or hurtful or mean. So what do you do? Much like the woman with the homes, is I want to be strong. I want to be strong, but I can't be strong because I could be bad and hurt people. So, but I want to be strong. That strong is bad. I want to be strong. Strong is good. No, strong is bad. And when we get wrapped into those loops, those conflicts, that has to be sorted out. The fact is, if one person used his physicality to cause pain for another, that means that person used his physicality to cause pain for another. Doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to do it, or you're going to do it, or somebody else is going to do it. A lot of that has to be looked at, and can be looked at, frankly, from a different point of view, that my father volunteered to demonstrate how not to do things. And my mother was helpful in making that very clear, how not to do things. I'll put this in this way. Here's a recipe, Tom, for being my son. And in keeping with what I just verbalized a little while ago about knowing how to do it wrong, my mother would have said something like this. She did say this, actually, these words. Let me tell you how you will not be my son. If you could do anything, you can do anything, and you will always be my son. Except if you ever hit a woman, you will cease to be my son. I don't know how old I was, 13, 14, 15, I'm not sure. But guess what? I got it. That was very, very clear. I knew how to do it right, and I knew how to do it wrong. And I wasn't willing to pay the price of wrong. So that was very helpful to know what the boundary was. And I'm presuming my brother's got the same sort of information from our mother. This morning when I started journaling, one of the things that was interesting to me, this aspect of my journaling, I go through a series of questions, and then when I get into what I call the meat of the session, is I ask this question every day. What do you want to talk about? But today, as I was starting to write that out, what I actually wrote out is, what do you want to think about? Oh, that's so funny. I burst out laughing. That is, there is no happiness without gratitude. Not going to happen. That ingredient of gratitude is, to me, absolutely essential to happiness. So, you know, it was very easy for me to look around. I happen to be in Naples, Florida. The weather is absolutely perfect, and it usually is. and married to a wonderful woman. Took me a few tries to get that right, but I kept going until I got it right. Got to give me an attaboy for that. And a puppy, and we have a friend staying with us for a couple of weeks. And our children and grandchildren are pretty happy, and they're becoming more and more happy as they're learning to become more effective at creating that happiness. And that's really cool. And here I am, writing about, thinking about, knowing that I'm going to be talking about the stuff that is most interesting to me, I find gratifying to talk about. It's like, wow, that's really, really cool. So, we had a dinner party last night, so let's go back into the kitchen. Let's talk about recipes for happiness, and I'm going to relate it to food, and it's pretty easy to do. I think our needs can be connected to the preparation and delivery of food, and I use this framework, convenient again. There, you could Google on human needs, and you could be reading from now for another 100 years. There's so much information, but because this is convenient, I use this framework. Survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, plus two. And so SFULI plus two. And the other two are the need to be right. And the seventh one is the need to look good / get approval. Those things tend to drive our behavior. And if we know what's driving our behavior, we know we have a different kind of orientation to happiness. It's pretty easy to imagine that somebody who has no roof over their head or no food, they're struggling with survival. If you said, hold on, I want to interview you. Can I interrupt your struggle for survival with this question? What would make you happy? It is likely that their answer is going to be related to their survival needs, food or water or clothing or warmth or shelter, something along those lines. And it makes a lot of sense that it would be that way. I think talking about food is such an interesting subject when you really can appreciate so many important aspects of life. The idea that when my wife happens to be a superb cook, she's very, very skillful at it, very imaginative. And so when she creates food, that process of creation, the assembly of that, is joyful for her. So when that plate is in front of me and I'm about to eat it, what I remember to do is to give thanks for it, to say grace, to bless the food and everybody, and especially my wife, for its delivery, and Mother Earth and God and so on, and all the purveyors that were involved in that process. But to now, I'm about to pick up the fork and put some food in my mouth. I realize that this step now that is about to occur is really where the joy and the happiness is magnified. As I put it in my mouth, and guess what's there? My taste buds. If I'm going to get any joy or taste out of this, it is while this food is being chewed. So chewing on this food, to me, is an extremely important aspect, spiritually, energetically, because this is really where we're going to maximize our pleasure and our joy. And not only that, you know, if you were a nutritionist or you had this kind of a background, you would say chewing the food well is the first step in digestion. Well, on a physical level, that certainly makes sense to me, and it is scientifically valid by the mixing of the food and breaking it down into smaller particles. So ultimately, the vibrations of that food, when it is digested later on in the process, is a lot easier on the body. So chew-chew-swallow, we're missing a tremendous opportunity. We're skipping part of the recipe for happiness by not maximizing this phase of ingestion. This is where we not only ingest the food, the material object of food or beverage, but this is where we ingest, by adding it, the joy, the happiness, the grace that's involved in it. I think we're really missing a great opportunity when we rush through food, which frankly is a challenge for me personally. We can eat food just to survive, and we can take it as this is a physical activity. I need to put fuel in the tank and then get on with the next thing. In a survival sort of way, maybe that's true. Maybe that's true. But in terms of other levels of experience and higher viewpoints, I think it's really a very limited way to do that. And you can imagine that food, because every family must eat, food really can be the center of a particular universe within a family. It is a place of great joy. It is where the food is prepared and assembled with more or less love. In fact, in some families, it is really the representation of the delivery of love. Here, I love you, and a plate of food appears in front of you, and it's like, okay. And in some scenarios, that is how love is delivered. Other forms of love seem not to be in the pantry, but food as love can be. And so to be able to look at it like that and just go, And this is where kids learn to be useful, doing the dishes and helping to prepare things and taking out the garbage and whatnot. This, helping set the table. All of this area can be really very valuable in discovering means or the ingredients of our own helpfulness. Survival and helpfulness and happiness. Survival, that makes us happy when we survive and less happy when we're not surviving. Being free is happier than not being free. Being useful is happier than not being useful, and so on. So you can really get the feeling that there's a lot to be learned and played with and enjoyed with regard to this whole area of food and preparation and recipes. Chewing on something, including chewing on the recipe, is what I recommend. Now, that sounds a little odd. You don't really mean chew on the recipe. You mean chew on the food that is produced as a result of following the recipe. No, I'm saying first chew on the recipe. And you've heard this. Oh, that guy's like a dog on a bone. That chew on this for a while. Chew on it for a while. This is part of the assimilation process. This is part of that definition process. When we chew on something for a while, we chew it this direction, we bite it from this direction, we move it around and bite it again and again and again. When we chew on a subject, when we chew on a recipe, when we chew on an idea, or we chew on some concept that we're interested in bringing into manifestation, that when we chew on it enough, we set ourselves up for a much easier assimilation and manifestation rather than just immediately start assembling stuff, which is really what happened to me in that dessert making example that I described a little while ago in Sonoma, California. Is I didn't chew on it. I didn't, I was just taking one step. Okay, take another step. Okay, take another step. I never saw the whole picture in my mind because of, whatever reason. What I certainly knew is I didn't do that. I didn't know how to see that picture. And so I never got into harmony with it. I was always out of step with that. So by chewing on these things from different angles, that's when we decide what it is. We start to assimilate it, and then we either swallow what we want or we spit out what we don't want. We don't have to take in what doesn't serve us. If we want to be happy, who doesn't? Well, if you polled people, you polled 1,000 people, so who wants to be happy? 1,000 people, I'm guessing, except maybe a mentally ill person or two, would say, I do. So you pretty much have 100% of the people saying, I want to be happy. But during surveys and so on, so many people say they are unhappy. So what does that mean? In the context of today's talk, they are using a recipe that produces unhappiness instead of a recipe that produces happiness. So, yikes, what's that about? Well, here are my viewpoints. Basically, 4 points that recently came into my awareness within the last week or so. And it seems real true to me. Do I follow this recipe all the time? No, but I do now recognize it, and as soon as I am aware of it, I can go back to my recipe. Number one, my use of my energies make me happy. My use of my energies make me happy. Two, my use of my energies make me unhappy. So if I'm having happiness, it's my use of my energies. If I'm having unhappiness, it's my use of my energies. When I pay attention and intention to control my use of my energies, I am more effective at producing my happiness. So I'm paying attention and I'm putting my intention on the way I use my energies. That's going to result in me being more happy or happier. Four, when I pay attention and put my attention and intention on controlling other people and the way they use their energies, I am less effective at producing my happiness. When I'm controlling me, I'm way better off. When I'm trying to control others, first of all, it's not going to work, and it just sets up conflict. But that's what is a recipe for unhappiness, trying to control other people. I cannot imagine this to be possible. I had friends that were professional musicians. They played for the New York Philharmonic. I lived in New York City for almost a dozen years, and they were neighbors in the building in Manhattan. And I cannot imagine a professional musician looking at another professional musician play at the same time they were trying to play at a very high level. So they were a flutist and a trumpet player, but let's can imagine a violinist. I'm a violinist and I want to be really, really excellent. And perhaps I am already an excellent violinist. And so now I'm going to have you standing in front of me and I'm going to be paying attention to what you're doing. We may be able to play a duet, but for me to be paying attention to you is going to be, and my intention of controlling how you play is going to cause me to misfunction and be unhappy with my own performance. This is a point. Every successful implementation, that is, recipe for happiness, requires that we have our feet on the ground. If you're going to be happy, have your feet on the ground. And this is what I mean by that. Become aware, know at the deepest level that we are supported. We are supported. We're held in place by gravity. We're supported by Mother Earth and whatever we're standing on between us and her. The way this entire world has been designed by God is, in fact, supporting us. If we can get into that place first and foremost, it is from that place we can successfully implement a recipe for happiness. And I would say there are a couple more steps, half a dozen or so. Define and focus on what you want. What happiness do you want? What does it mean to you? And choose one of those areas of perhaps 12 worlds or any other aspect of your life that you want to focus on. Look at what you want in that world. Not what you don't want. What you don't want helps bring into focus what you do want. So focus on what you do want. Second, maybe this is second, maybe it's first, maybe it's second, is define and accept the identity of the person you are before you start taking action, which would be step three. So if you want to be a musician and you're about to pick up a violin for the very, very first time, just the fact that you have that desire says that you have the seed of that identity. This form of happiness exists in you already. It just needs to be nurtured and developed and brought into fuller expression. That is, your fuller knowingness of it. So that identity, if you have that desire, you you have the ability to fulfill it. That's a great area that's dealt with in the fantastic book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. He's a firm believer that if you can have the desire, you've got the means to satisfy it. But you don't have, oh, I desire this, and then, like, oh, I don't have the capability. Uh-uh. If you've got one, you got them both. And so when you have that identity, just a teeny, teeny bit, just it will start to grow. You don't have to be Van Cliver in the first time you touch a piano. But if you have inspiration and the desire to be that superb, then you have the capability to be that superb. Then define and focus on what you are doing, what you are doing. Control your energies as you move physical things around, as you think, as you feel. You're moving all these energies. Define and focus on that. Then add the ingredients that you've determined that are needed for this creation of what you want. And then not so much like a cake, flour and milk and eggs and butter and so on. They're invisible. They're non-physical things. Add the non-physical ingredients. All physical ingredients were non-physical at some point in their creation. So if we add the non-physical ingredients, the physical ingredients will show up. I think the fact, five, I say, that we have to accept that we have a partnership with the universe. We have a partnership with the unseen. We have a partnership with God, our creator, the creative force, capital C, capital F, and spirit. However you see this invisible, empowering, creative energy, we have a partnership. And that energy flowing to us and through us allows us to fulfill what it is we're focused on and what it is we intend to have. Six, be willing to adjust. Add a little of that. A little less of this, a little more of that, a little less of this, a little bit longer of this, da, 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 da. You know, a lot of things that we're creating don't have a defined time. It's not like I've made this cake 12 times and I know 37 minutes at 350 is really exactly what I require in this particular oven. We know that when we change ovens or we, other things go on, even altitudes change the length of time for these what used to be predictable baking experiences. But a lot of the stuff that we want to create in our lives, health or happiness or prosperity or loving relationships, is like, what's the time? How long does it take? How long does it take? I'll watch my watch. It takes as long as it takes. Those things are not defined. But if we focus on enjoying every step of the process and knowing that we're supported, we have ground to stand on that is helping us in this process, we have a partnership, and we can adjust until what we've created is according to our individual tastes. Throughout that whole process of those first six steps, I would be adding appreciation and gratitude liberally, just boom. The fact that here we are on a today using technology and we're accessing information, just we are in one of the most blessed positions imaginable on planet Earth. In fact, some of what we're experiencing at this very moment is outside the realm of the imagination of billions of people. So for us to add appreciation and gratitude to our circumstances and know that we are in this creative process, is we are so blessed. We are so blessed. And as I often do, this is step eight, is to make reference to creation. I like God's model. Create some, see a need, create it, declare it to be good. See a need, create it, declare it to be good. See a need, create it, declare it to be good. We can declare the outcome of our implementing our recipe for health, for happiness, for love, to be good. and then we continue as needed. We're never going to get it all done. We're going to be like God in that. We're going to do something on the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And we can do something in the next minute, or the next hour, the next day, the next week, the next month. We are going to continue creating. And if we're going to be able to create, and we are, why not create using our mindfully designed recipes for happiness? I think that's a much better approach than doing things blindly. I'd like to end the service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator in connection to all that is, all happiness, all information, all joy, all love. Help us to understand our relationship to you, our ability to access your gifts. Implement them in our individual lives for your honor, to demonstrate happiness and alignment and high vibration to our families, to our friends, to strangers, to absolutely every one of your creations. Creating happiness seems to be the most fun game we could be involved in. And thank you for setting this in motion. It is so. Thank you. Amen.